864, Senator Benson. This is a public employees long-term care insurance program, local government employee participation authorization. Welcome to the committee, Senator
Thank
Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I think it's been a while since I've been in your committee. Could I ask someone to move Senate File 864 so we can begin discussion?
So moved.
We have a motion to move Senate File 864. With that, I think what I will do is, before you get started, Senator Benson, I think I will have our Ms. James explain why your bill is in front of this committee for the members.
Mr. Chair and members, this bill is before this committee because it relates to a benefit, an optional benefit offered to state employees. It's long-term care insurance, and it may, as the fiscal note describes, there may be some impact to adding the employees of local units of government to the plan, and therefore might have an impact on state employees.
All right. Thank you very much. Senator Benson, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Briefly, currently state employees are eligible for long-term care insurance. This would expand availability to local units of employees of local units of government. It is an option for those employees. As you can see from the fiscal note, it does not add to costs for the state, nor would it add to costs for those local units of government. Long-term care is a significant risk in the future of health care in the state of Minnesota as our population ages, and this is just another mechanism for us to encourage the purchase of long-term care. I have with me two testifiers, Kathy Tinglestead and Melanie Alt, both from Anoka County, and here to help give you any necessary information in this decision process.
Thank you very much. Please state your name and you may proceed.
My name is Melanie Alt. I'm the Director of Human Resources at Anoka County. Thank you for hearing this bill today. Long-term care insurance is an important part of health care costs in Minnesota and across the nation. Those without the financial means to care for themselves or their loved ones in a long-term care setting, much of that cost falls on the state. The county provides services to support that. So those without insurance, the burdens increase for state and county as well as the cost. We are looking to reinstate the original language that was originally in the bill to implement the program for the state's employees. Local governments of Minnesota were originally included in the available in the people this was supposed to be rolled out to. At the last minute, they were taken out, and it was only rolled out to state employees. Many jurisdictions don't offer a long-term care insurance benefit or product. It's not on the forefront like health insurance or life insurance might be for an employee benefit package. This is something that Anoka County feels very strongly that ought to be offered, and enrolling through the state's program or with the state's program would be a very easy process, painless. It's a well-accepted benefit through all the state's employees. It's local units of government, much like the state employees, the same kind of industry, and we are requesting that local governments be able to enroll as well.
Any questions for our testifier? And for the record, we do have a quorum. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are the people that would enroll this, would enroll here, would they be eligible for the partnership, long-term care partnership program? Is that one of the options that they have eligibility for?
Sure, what the long-term partnership is.
Okay. Senator Benson, did you?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gazelka, I'm not familiar with.
Mr. Chair, back in 2006, we, five or six, passed the long-term care partnership program where if you buy your own long-term care insurance and then whatever care you provided for that you paid for, you got to protect your assets up to that amount, but it's not every policy that has it, and I'm just curious to see if yours does.
I believe that the state's program, that is an option depending upon which level or which track you choose that would be available, as well as the state's income tax credit of $100. Mm-hmm.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then as far as premiums, if they're eligible, do they pay 100% of the premium, or does the county pay a portion?
Ms. Saul, before you answer, could you pull the microphone? They're telling me you need to be a little closer to the microphone. Thank you.
Certainly. I'm sorry. The question was who pays the premiums. This is all employee paid, and it is a voluntary choice. It's not a requirement.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, if I can make a comment.
Senator Gazelka.
Just the general benefit of purchasing long-term care insurance, if they then need care rather than the state paying for it, the long-term care policy pays for it. And in states that have studied this, very little cost is paid out from the state when people have purchased their own long-term care policy.
That's right.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Wigger.
And I believe maybe it was pointed out in the testimony, it saves the state money, too, in terms of potential dollars going for nursing home costs that are usually subsidized at after the insurance is run out. So I think it's very proactive. There's no opposition, is there?
I haven't gotten to that far to ask for more testifiers. Do you have
so.
Another testifier, Senator Benson?
No, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? If so, please come forward at this time. You can grab another chair and pull it up, sir. Please state your name, and you may proceed.
Mr. Chair, Senators, good afternoon. My name is Bruce Anderson. I am the Benefits Manager for the State Employee Group Insurance Program, also known as CGIP. I'm here today to represent the department in the absence of Mr. Morocco. He's unable to attend, but does give his regards. CGIP
we'll
manages.
We'll miss him, Mr. Yeah. Anderson.
CGIP manages the long-term care insurance program for insurance-eligible state employees and retirees, as well as their spouses and parents. The state's long-term care insurance program is fully paid by those who elect it, including the cost of the administration of the program. There are no state dollars involved. Local units already have access to a long-term care insurance program called the Muni Pool. It's offered through a private broker, and access to the state's plan would be another option. The local groups likely to join the state's plan will be those that cost more than the existing pool, since they will be those that can't find a cheaper alternative. The addition of members with a higher cost than the current membership will cause the premiums to increase for current state employees. Adding locals will also increase the administration portion of the premium. Currently, the majority of the participating membership is serviced through the state's electronic enrollment and payroll system. Most premiums are deducted from paychecks, and the product is advertised alongside the state's other offerings. Administering to local units will entail a whole new administrative system that will need to advertise, enroll, and collect premiums on a statewide basis. Developing, implementing, and maintaining the system for one product will be costly. So in conclusion, adding local units of government will not cost the state anything, and it will not put the state at risk. However, we think it is likely it will increase the premium burden for state employees. Conversely, it's likely that some local employees will be able to obtain long-term care insurance at a lower cost than they could elsewhere.
Thank you very much. Any questions, Senator Thompson?
Mr. Anderson, help me out here from an underwriting standpoint. I don't understand that. If the pool of people increases, unless there was a reason to believe that statistically they're more likely to be a higher risk category for underwriting purposes, I don't understand why that would necessarily increase the premium structure.
Mr. Anderson.
Chair and Senator, as I outlined, since folks have currently have other options for long-term care insurance, we're believing that the people that come into our program now would be at a higher risk. So we think that those higher risk individuals coming up may put pressure on the existing premium and raise the premium for existing employees.
Senator Gazelka.
Just a thought, but most people don't collect on long-term care until well after they've retired. So I can see where there may be a small
percentage, but have you calculated what you think the increase is going to be? It can't be much.
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't think we've calculated that. I could get back to you. We've done a fiscal note on it. I'm not sure it addresses it in that detail.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The fiscal note that we asked for this bill shows no net cost, and so I'd be very interested in seeing the testifiers referred to fiscal note.
All right. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Julie Blyle, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5. We represent 43,000 public employees statewide, including the state employees in Minnesota, as well as some of the local units of government. We were included in a task force report done in 2010, and we have had the same position as this bill has come before the legislature in many past sessions. And that position is we're supportive of long-term care, but we do not want to see the local units of government added to CGIP for simply the reason that was stated, that the expense to it will come at the expense of the state employees, any additional costs. Therefore, there are other avenues for local units of government to achieve this insurance, and our position would be that they use the other avenues other than CGIP. Thank you.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to either of the testifiers, I must not be understanding how this works, because I would assume that, and I'm very supportive of Senator Benson's bill, I think it, you know, long-term care insurance is one of the huge pieces to the puzzle of solving what is a coming disaster with the baby boomers retiring, et cetera, and aging. Okay, we got a group of state employees that are am I correct that they're also paying their own premium, Senator Benson? Is that correct?
That is correct.
And then we would add local employees that would be paying their own premium, and you're concerned about kind of almost a hybrid of sort of an adverse selection problem. Why would there be more likely to be that problem within the population of local government employees as opposed to state government employees?
So I want to chime in here, Senator Thompson, because I'm thinking the same thing, questioning the same thing. I guess as I'm trying to mull it through here is that If the local units have the opportunity to jump in, I could see, and of course it bothers me that they would leave the private sector and jump into the public sector insurance world. That kind of bothers me a little bit. But I'm afraid that those that would jump in are going to be the ones with the high risk, that their premiums are going to end up being higher on the private side. So they jump into the state side. My concern is if they do that, then that's going to change the rating of what the public employees end up paying for their insurance. If I'm reading this right, I mean, if I'm going through this, and Senator Benson, if you can help both Senator Thompson and I with this, because I'm trying to see where the advantages are here and who the advantages are going towards. And Mr. Anderson, I'm concerned when you say that this is going to be costly to administer a new system, and we don't have any kind of fiscal note on that. That's another question. Senator Benson, maybe you can help us move through this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Thompson, for your questions. I did ask Ms. Ault to come back up to the table. I don't see any reason why local unit of government employees would be a higher risk pool than state employees. There's nothing inherent in being employed at a local unit of government that makes you a more risky prospect. Yes, they might select out of private sector purchases into a lower cost, broader pool for long-term care, but the state employees are already doing that, are opting out of private sector coverage. There's nothing that compels the purchase of this product by a state employee. And so we're talking about broadening a pool with, in my opinion, fairly similar profiles. And perhaps Ms. Ault can speak more directly.
Oh, let her answer first.
All right. Ms. Ault.
I would agree with that summary. There was no evidence to show that a local government set of employees would differ in its profile than the state employees. Likewise, the statement or presumption that those who would join the state plan would inherently be more costly than those who are already in the state plan, I don't believe would hold true in that most local governments don't even offer long-term care insurance. It's not something that's up on their radar. It's not something that they've gone out and shopped. They haven't gone out and shopped to see what are the costs. It's a complex area that isn't a high immediate need like health care, which they do shop, which they do delve into. And so we're looking to make this to be an easy enrollment, an easy option for local government employees to take so that they do become insured, and that in turn, in the bigger picture, potentially relieves the burden on the state.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know right now, the local governments, is there medical underwriting when they fill out a long-term care policy, and then at the state level there isn't? Or are they about, if they're about the same now, I don't see any significant change in rate. But if they're different, then there could be.
Ms. Ault.
I'm not aware that there is a medical underwriting. This would be an opportunity offered at probably the beginning of employment or at a stated maybe open enrollment window type of option, so that you wouldn't face that adverse selection type of opportunity. Reference was also made to the Muni pool being available to local governments, and that is true. When that was implemented, it was at an 8% higher cost than the state's premiums were. And when it was reevaluated, when the study was done in 2009, it was at a 10% higher cost. And so we see the state's plan as inherently more attractive.
Are there... Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Benson, how do the county employees in Anoka County, for example, the AFSCME employees, do they want this?
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, it is my assumption, as with most employees, that when a benefit is made available that hasn't been currently available, more will choose to avail themselves of that benefit. Currently, there is no long-term care coverage offered in Anoka County.
Oh, thank you.
Any further discussion? Are there any other testifiers? Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I, unless, as Senator Gazelka said, there is a different standard applied to getting local employees into this pool as opposed to state, if anything, statistically, the cost should stay the same or come down. I frankly find it bizarre that there is a union representative, and you're free to comment on it if you like, in here arguing that unionized employees shouldn't have access at the local level to a program that protects them and their families against the deterioration of their assets in the long run. And I can't hear anything that would lead me to believe that there's any reasonable mathematical explanation for why premiums should go up. I'm just not following this at all.
Ms. Blyle, would you like to respond?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thompson, I want to be very clear. Our concern is the cost when you are moving the local government employees into the current plan. We're not against local government units offering long-term care to their employees. They have that option now through the munis, and there may be other venues that they can seek to provide that coverage. But the report that was issued in 2010 demonstrates there will be some costs, and those costs would then be placed on the current state employees that are in the plan. So there's a clear distinction there as to our opposition. Our opposition is in terms of merging them into the current plan, not opposed to offering them, which many local units of government have currently offered long-term care coverage to their employees. As for the adverse selection, there may be adverse selection. Until there's a study done to determine that, I don't think any of us knows what the impact on the actual fund would be.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't mean to beat a dead horse, but I'm going to beat a little more on this one. Because if the rate that we are collecting at the state is enough to cover what we're paying out to those that need long-term care, then I don't see much difference when we add local government people into that system. But if we're not collecting and the state is actually kicking in money in addition to that rate, well, then I can see where there would be a loss.
Ms. Blythe.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Gazelka, I'd defer to the state for a comment as to the actual cost, but I would assume there would be some marketing costs and some administrative costs in dealing with the local units of government. Again, it would take an analysis to determine what the actual cost would be, but that cost under this structure, by having the fiscal note be zero, would then be absorbed by the current employees who have bought coverage into the state plan.
Okay. here's what I would suggest. This bill has a stop in local government next. I really need to know, and I think Senator Vanderveer is going to want to know, how we handle your statement, Mr. Anderson, that this is going to be costly to administer. And I think the citizens, I feel some from this committee wondering, is there really going to be an administrative cost? And if so, who absorbs the burden of that cost? And, I like what you're doing, Senator Benson, but I think we need to have that answer when that makes it to the next stop. And I think that's what everybody, I'm hearing people kind of moving towards that. So, Mr. Anderson, however you could work with Senator Benson before it makes it to Senator Vanderveer's committee, I think that would be very beneficial for local government.
Mr.
Senator
Chair?
Thompson?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a valid concern, although I will tell you that when you look at the number of state employees and you look at the pool that is being used to calculate the risk and underwrite the premiums and administer the program per person, it has to be extraordinarily minimal to the extent that there'd be any increase. And as a matter of public policy, this to me, Senator Benson, is about as good a program as I've seen come through this committee this session, because it is allowing individuals to protect themselves against the difficulties that come with old age and the inability to take care of oneself and protect one's family, and it's putting responsibility on people to do that, yet leveraging these large groups to keep the cost down. I would encourage the members to support this, and I certainly hope the administration's on board.
Senator Benson.
And Mr. Chair and committee members, when the testifiers appeared at the table, it was the first I had heard of any opposition to this bill. And you have my pledge that I will work with these individuals. But I have also worked with Commissioner Jessen in the Human Services Department, and long-term care initiatives are a significant part of her agenda over her term. And so I think that this bill is in line in general with the wishes of the administration, and with your blessing, I would ask for a yes vote on this bill.
Senator Wigger.
Well, Mr. Chair, we're all for long-term care insurance for the reasons stipulated earlier, but I hadn't heard any opposition to this until just now. Mr. Chair, I think you pointed out a couple of financial impact questions. There's as to what could occur, and so I'd like to see the discussion go. But I would move that we refer without recommendation Senate File 864 to the Local Government Committee.
Motion on the floor to. Okay, your motion was to move this without recommendation to local government, correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
I would like to move to amend the amendment to change without to with recommendation.
Senator Olson. Senator Olson, if it's agreeable with you, I would just soon work on the first motion and resolve that issue first, and then take up your motion at that time.
Well, Mr. Chair, if one would, so everyone that would prefer to send it with recommendation would vote against his motion.
That's correct.
Mr. Chair.
It's a given.
Senator Gazelka.
I think this should go with recommendation. I think this is a good bill. There are a few things that we want to get to the bottom to, but I, you know, my whole conversation here has been that I don't think those expenses are, I think they're minuscule. Mm-hmm. And to open this up to the local governments is a very positive thing. So that's why, for me, it's, I want this to, and I've not heard it that way, so I'd,
sure. You know,
maybe more information on that would be helpful.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator
Zelka, I tend to think that too, but I'd like to see that impact before I
reach to a conclusion. Senator Wigger, I would also say that once it the information is gotten and it hits local government, if we want to see this back here because there is something larger, than we will have it come back to this committee. Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, we also have the option of laying the bill on the table, and I could do more work and ask for a future hearing in this committee if it pleases the chair.
Let's move on the motion that's on the floor right now. Senator Benson. Senator Wigger renews his motion to move Senate File 864 to local government without a recommendation. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion does not prevail. All right, Senator Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that Senate File 864 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Local Government Elections.
On the motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. Please, I know you will, Senator Benson, and I think that is going to help everybody by getting that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Second item on the agenda is Senate File 1544, Senator DeCryf. This bill, as Senator comes up, county, cities, towns, land conveyance to congressionally chartered veteran service organizations for less than market value authorization. Members, this bill was sent to us from the local government and the elections. Senator DeCryf, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee. Senate File 1544, as amended in the last committee, will allow counties, cities, towns, or other public corporations to lease or convey land to a congressionally chartered veterans organization for public use for less than market value. For purposes of this bill, congressionally chartered veteran service organizations is a veteran organization that has been granted a charter by the United States Congress. These organizations have been recognized and approved by Congress for their mission and work on behalf of veterans and their contributions to the communities they serve. Examples of some of these include, but are not limited to, the American Legion, AMVETS, or the VFW. This bill will require that the conveyance or lease of the land be approved by the local governing body. The organization receiving the land cannot lease or sell the property for 5 years after receiving the land.
All right. Do you have a testifier here with you, Senator?
I do. It's Mayor Gene Keogh from the city of Montgomery.
Mayor Keogh, I just love the Veterans Memorial.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and Senate Committee members. I'm Jean Keogh, the mayor of the city of Montgomery. And I'd just like to start with a little background. In October of 2010, the Montgomery American Legion and the VFW were informed they would have to relocate their Veterans Memorial, which up until that time was located on Montgomery Lonsdale School property. In 2010, the school district held a building referendum, which passed, and as part of the building project, a new parking lot was planned for the Veterans Memorial site. As a result, the American Legion and VFW had to find a new home for their memorial. The memorial consisted of the American, Minnesota, and POW MIA flags and a granite monument. The American Legion and the VFW researched a number of different locations throughout Montgomery and determined the best location for the Veterans Memorial to be a vacant lot owned by the City of Montgomery. Representatives of the American Legion and the VFW approached the City Council requesting that we gift the property to the American Legion for the purpose of establishing a new Veterans Memorial. In their presentation to the Council, our veterans presented plans for the new memorial, which consisted of expanding and enhancing the original memorial. In reviewing Minnesota Statute 465.035, the city learned that it could not convey the land to the American Legion. Even though the memorial would be enjoyed and visited by the entire community, the city, by law, simply could not gift the land to them. But the City Council still desired to assist in relocating the Veterans Memorial to this site. So in the alternative, the City Council entered into an agreement with the American Legion regarding the use and maintenance of the property and dedicated it as a city park, naming it Veterans Memorial Park. The City of Montgomery supports Senate File Number 1544, authored by Senator DeKreif, to allow any county, town, city, or other public corporation to convey land to a chartered veteran service organization for public use when authorized by its governing body. We believe it should be a governing body's right to convey property to a veteran service organization if the property is to be used for public purpose, such as paying tribute and honoring all veterans who have served our country. Today, many veterans organizations are financially challenged as they are dependent on their memberships and donations, which can limit the scope of their projects. In order to accomplish major projects such as establishing a veterans memorial or even refurbishing one, they often depend on that limited assistance of those donations. Therefore, it is our hope that you will support Senate File Number 1544, giving local units of government throughout the state the ability to honor and express our pride in the veterans who have sacrificed and served our great nation. Our veterans are the cornerstone of our community. This bill would allow us to collaborate on other projects for the benefit of our communities and opens the door to partnering with them. We feel that this bill will strengthen the veterans organizations throughout the state, and that will make stronger communities. And I want to thank you for this opportunity and for your time today.
Thank you very much. Any questions for our testifier or Senator DeKreif? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only part that kind of, well, I don't know if it puzzles me, but it would concern me, is that the Chartered Veterans Service Organization could, in fact, sell the land that it's received by one of these after 5 years. It would seem to me that it would make more sense to have a reversionary clause if it was no longer going to be used for the purpose it was intended, that it would revert for the same consideration that it was by which it was attained to the public entity.
Senator DeKreif.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Olson. If you would like to put that forward as a as an amendment, I would consider it a friendly amendment. I actually added that clause in to try to keep any shenanigans out. If somebody were to want to give some land and then be able to resell it quickly to a developer or something, I wanted to keep those types of things out. And typically 5 years would keep that from happening, but your idea, I think, is a very good one.
It just kind of brings back the memory of, not in this kind of situation, but the hospital, the Ridgeview Hospital in Waconia, was a municipal hospital. And it was the time was right to go to a nonprofit status and separate it from that particular situation and relationship. But when we had to pass a law to do that, But we did have, you know, with the attractiveness of acquiring some of these firms, acquiring hospitals, we wanted to assure that it would retain that status. And so if, in fact, there was any attempt to do that, it would, in fact, revert to the city. And so it assures that that will stay in that capacity, unless there's something, you know, that we don't even foresee that a future legislature might want to deal with. But I think that that's – I don't expect that this in this situation that you're going to want to, you know, move that memorial again or for any reason let it go. But I think that that 5-year limitation, I can understand your purpose, but I would be much more comfortable with a reversionary clause that based on the original consideration.
Right. I think I'm getting collective head nods here, Senator DeCryf, and I've asked Ms. James if she could whip up that language quick. What she would rather have me do at this time is just lay it on the table, because she wants to make sure, and she wants to go back and grab and specifically look at what happened with Senator
Mr.
Olson.
Mr. Chair, there may be other discussion that right. is around that, but I'd be happy to.
Senator Olson, do you remember what year that was? And so Ms. James could maybe look at that language and we could. I know I'm testing you at this hour of the day.
Yeah, it's probably at least 10 years ago.
Okay, all right.
But I probably could. If I haven't turned off my phone, I probably could make a call and quickly find out.
Okay. Well, why don't we, in an effort to keep moving forward here, Senator DeCryf, we'll lay Senate File 1544 on the table and come up with that verbiage, and then we'll get it back here before the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Ms. James, do you think that's something we could have? We have an opening on Monday that maybe we could bring it up. Senator DeCryf, we'll work on that, and then we'll have you back on Monday.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Let's move on to the third item on the agenda, Senate File 1698. Senator DeCryf.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair.
Let me just bill is State Aid Road Program Rulemaking Authority Modification. Over dimension motor vehicle permit provisions modification, bridge inspection and signing account establishment, water permitting process for transportation projects requirement. Members, the policy in this bill was discussed in Transportation Committee, and we are only discussing the rulemaking portions of the bill. Likewise, there is a fiscal note to this bill, and that will be discussed in Finance Committee as well. So. Maybe before we start, Senator DeCryf, we'll have Mr. Lundeen go over that fiscal side.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Everybody should have a copy of the 12-page fiscal note, and I think it's easier if we go to the individual agencies. So starting on the second page, it's kind of detailing the costs to the Department of Transportation. And the costs that you see up at the top, there's some cost to municipal state aid, county state aid, and the trunk highway fund. In fiscal year 13, about $8,000 of actually it's savings that show up within those three funds. And that's just related to the rulemaking. And then there's a one-time cost to the trunk highway fund to do with the water permitting process. And that's the $40,000 that you see showing up there. And then as you go down looking at the net expenditures, it's just kind of totaling that up, the savings and then the cost in fiscal year 13. And then the other change going on here, which is related to a change in where some of the dollars were going into the trunk highway fund. There's a change putting those dollars into the special revenue fund. So that would be the $568,000 you see in fiscal year 13. And that is just revenue from the forest product permits and some special farm products permits related to the bridge inspection and the signing account. So it's just a change of which fund those dollars are going into. If we turn over to page 5, we get to the pollution control portion of the fiscal note and the $58,000 cost to the Environmental Fund. That is the cost of 0.57 of an FTE. And if you look on the next page, page 6, under the expenditure and revenue formula, the costing out of that employee is included down there. If we go on to page 8 of the fiscal note, it's dealing with the cost to the DNR. And the costs there are $13,000, some cost to the general fund and some to other funds within the agency. And these costs are being absorbed by the DNR. And then going to page 11 of the fiscal note, it's dealing with the Water and Soil Resources Board and their costs there, too, to the general fund. That's also related to employee costs, but the agency is absorbing those costs. So I think, in short, those are the costs on the fiscal note.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Lundeen. Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if this is directed toward Senator Coif or Mr. Lundeen or maybe some of the witnesses, but it appears that the fiscal note, as just articulated by Mr. Lundeen, has cost going back to the agency in terms of the FTEs, but there's no hiring of any additional FTEs, but it looks like people will be working on this proposal on a full-time basis. So I'm curious to know what, given some of the cuts to government state agencies, what will be done or not done within the agency in terms of the diversion of staff time to this proposal, if anybody can answer that.
Mr. Lundeen, did you want to respond to that?
I'm not sure that I can directly answer that question. It's not laid out in the fiscal notes, so I think it would be best if there was someone from the agency that could maybe address that.
Is there anybody from transportation or DNR who would like to try that?
PC.
Mr. Chairman, my concern
for the PCA here. Any of the? I know when we discussed this in transportation, as I recall, Senator DeKreif, were they not absorbing, and could pick this up with the current employees that they have? FTEs, is that, as I recall?
I'm not sure, Mr. Chair.
All right. Okay. Senator Cohen?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not objecting to what I think is the, you know, the heart of the bill itself. My concern is maybe a more general one that obviously, and this is not a reflection just on this legislature, I mean, we've been cutting agencies now for the last decade, and some of that might be warranted. Some of it might not be, but where we have legislation that says, the agency can take it out of the existing budget, I mean, at some point, you know, you can't do that anymore. And I just wonder, because I see I haven't added up the number of FTEs in the bill, but it looks like it's maybe as many as 15 or so. So that's why I wonder if there's been testimony, if it was in transportation or, I don't know, Senator Cliff, has this bill been to the environment, to Senator Ingebrigtsen's committee as well, or?
This, Senator DeKreif, I believe this is going to be re-referred to the Committee on Finance, Senator Cohen, but.
Okay, maybe we could get the answer as an overall answer.
And I hear what you're saying, Senator Cohen, and that's why, as I remember this bill on transportation, there was never an argument about taking and being able to handle that with the current employees, okay. But you do bring up a point, but. I would have thought that if there was some concern that way, they might have showed up for this committee meeting. So, but we'll have it in finance.
Mr. Chairman, my experience has been that where you're dealing with the non-general fund dollars, there's a little bit more maneuvering room than with general fund dollars. So maybe that's part of the answer.
Okay. Would you like to testify, sir?
Yes, I would.
Please state your name and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Randy Maluchnik. I'm president of the Association of Minnesota Counties and a Carver County Commissioner. This piece of streamlining legislation is important to the counties in improving transportation project service delivery and continuing to provide safe roads and travel for our free market commerce. We rely on expertise from our county engineers in a good partnership with MDOT State Aid Office to identify these three strategic areas that will allow for new engineering standards to be implemented in a timely fashion with adequate input, provide that funds will be dedicated for proper bridge signage and inspection for certain overweight loads, and work with state agencies to find the most efficient ways to make sure the proper permits are acquired for transportation projects. And AMC would like to thank Senator DeCrive for assisting and advocating for safe, efficient, and timely delivery of local transportation projects. And AMC would like to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee for your time and consideration with this legislation.
Thank you very much. Sir, please state your name and proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Alan Goodman, Lake County Engineer. I'm also co-chair of the County Engineers Legislative Committee and also down here for Duluth Days, but I like to call it North Shore Days. And I just want to, I do have some handouts here and just point out that we've got a picture up here of Two Harbors, the old tugboat. And I think what we're talking about here is things that kind of represent this old tugboat. It used to bring in the ore carriers into the harbor of Two Harbors. Now, of course, the ore carriers have bow thrusters. They don't need tugboats anymore. What we're trying to do is just make our operations a little more efficient. The senator earlier had a comment in regards to the costs of these some of these changes, and we would submit, if we're doing things right with Senator DeGrife's bill, that we'll actually be saving money over time, expediting the rulemaking process through the Office of State Aid, where we've got a wonderful partnership at present, allowing for bridge inspections to be done in a timely fashion so as to prevent any disastrous consequences of bridges going down. And just finally, to look at streamlining the permitting process for our waters permits, which involve a myriad of state agencies. What we'd hope to do is sit down with those folks and revisit operations. And I think it's it just makes sense to do that on a periodic basis, to revisit operations and see how things can be changed. And the bottom line for us is we'll report back to the legislature and hopefully we'll come up with some recommendations that actually save time and makes state agencies and our lives a little bit easier. Thank you.
I was going to say, Mr. Goodman, didn't you pronounce the name of the city wrong? I thought it was Duluth.
Oh, North Shore.
Okay. All
and
right.
North
Thank
Shore.
You.
They conveniently invite some other folks along, so we do tag along. And
all right.
You're all welcome to the reception at the Crown Plaza tonight. Compliments of the city, Duluth.
Thank you. Senator DeCrife.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I just had someone from the Association of Minnesota Counties just whisper in my ear that that it would probably take a total of four workshops to utilize the people that we have in current positions in order to get geared up for this bill.
All right. Any further discussions? Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate File 1698 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
On that motion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Carlson.
Thank you very much.
Fourth item on the agenda is, or Senator DeCrive. Fourth item on the agenda is Senate File 1842.
Congratulations.
Senator DeCrive is back with us again. This is the E-Verify program usage requirement. I believe you do have an author's amendment, Senator DeCrive.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. I have an A1 amendment. It's a delete everything amendment.
Senator DeCrife has the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor, or Senator Daley.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move that for him. I'll move the A1 amendment to Senate File 1842.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails to the bill as amended, Senator Daley, or DeCrife.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee. What this bill it does is it basically brings E-Verify back to the state. Senate File 1842, as amended, would require new hires in the legislative, executive, and judicial branches be submitted to the E-Verify process to ensure that our newly hired employees in state government are legal to work in the U.S. The E-Verify program utilizes information between Homeland Security and the Social Security Administration. I-9 forms the information on I-9 forms is entered into an online site, typically by an HR person working within companies. It takes about 4 to 6 minutes to enter and run the information through the e-verify system, and there's no cost to using the system. A few years ago, Governor Pawlenty required by executive order that all state hires go through e-verify, as well as for contracts let by the state over $50,000. Governor Pawlenty's executive order to use e-verify was allowed to expire under Governor Dayton. In the budget resolution last year, there was an agreement for state contracts over $50,000 to continue using e-verify. So what we're trying to do essentially with this bill is to bring e-verify to Minnesota, bring the state government up to the speed that most of the companies or many of the companies in Minnesota currently utilize. And I would stand for questions.
Any questions for Senator DeCrive?
Thank you.
Senator Torres Ray.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, he has my name right.
Thank goodness.
Senator, it's been kind of the custom now that we just kind of see these amendments coming and we kind of prepare for something and then we have an amendment that is different, so we have to kind of pause and think about what is the difference. So I want to say to you, Mr. Chair, that sometimes it's kind of difficult to have meaningful participation if we have an amendment before us that really changes the language in a significant way. So we prepare to come to testify on something, and then the bill is different. So I had a question for you, Senator, with respect to the federal e-verify program. So in your previous bill, and you changed that, so it no longer reads the way it did before, which is better, because obviously now you're asking the commissioner to implement it. So my question is, some of the issues that we contemplated when we reviewed this previously, and I was very close to the Pawlenty administration reviewing this with implementation of contracts, because, you know, we have 87 counties that we work with, 11 reservations, the subcontract with hundreds of nonprofit organizations that provide services to the state. So the magnitude of these implementation is quite big for the state. And what at the time the Pawlenty administration agreed to do was that they will look into the implementation of his executive order really never became quite clear as to how it worked and how it was done. We really never knew. It was kind of announced at a time, you know, that was kind of election time, and then it kind of disappeared, so we just kind of didn't know how it was implemented. But you're bringing it back as a law. You're trying to introduce legislation to get it done. So I need to know how is this going to be implemented and how your conversations with the different counties and local authorities and the different nonprofit organizations who ultimately will have to work with the state for the implementation for E-Verify, and it's quite a cost to the local authorities. I don't know, you know, if you have had this conversation and how that conversation actually went about.
Senator DeCrive.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Torres Ray. What we're looking at doing this with the state hires. So essentially what we're doing here is with the state hires in the legislative, executive, and judicial branches, you're talking about counties and this bill doesn't talk about counties.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The a lot of the contracts that we have, Senator, between counties and states, these employees kind of work together. So is it your intent that these reviews will only take place for state employees? It's just not clear to me. And again, this is an example, Senator, of you know, what you prepare for something and then you come and you're surprised with an amendment, so you just kind of, I can't, I'm not clear as to, so this is only state employees, because you said appointed, appointing authorities and the legislative, executive, and judicial branches. Let's do this.
Senator Torres-Ray, I got an idea here.
Mm-hmm.
How about if we ask Ms. James to tell us what the difference is and try to clarify that up, and then you can continue.
That'll be great.
Let's see what we can do here. Ms. James.
Mr. Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, members, I can give a page and line number amendment to the bill as originally presented to get us to the A1. On line 1.7, delete use. On line 1.8, delete the federal e-verify program for, and insert before all, verify the employment eligibility of. And then on line 1.8, after employees but before the period, insert using the federal e-verify program. This amendment eliminates the word use on line 1.7 because use was vague.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Okay, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, it seems to me that the only change is in the first sentence, and it doesn't change anything. It just clarifies, just through the sentence structure, what is intended.
Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I was just trying to I'm intrigued with the legislation. Sometimes we kind of see these come across, and I was just trying to see, is this just a matter of you feeling as though the executive order has expired and now you want to put what was being done in the executive order into law, or had you identified that there was a problem? Are we, is there an issue with employees that are employed by the legislative, executive, and judicial branch may not be eligible to work in the United States? Is that a problem we've identified, Senator?
Senator DeCrye.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hayden. Senator Hayden, what we find in private industry is if a person is hired and later to be found to be ineligible to work in the United States, it's a very expensive process because you've just spent maybe several months going through a training process that's very expensive and extensive, and that could all be avoided just by taking 4 to 6 minutes to punching this information into the computer. It's still the same I-9 form that you use, but it just takes care of any of the potential problems of a long training process where you may waste an awful lot of time and have to let an employee go. So we're trying to do this up front and make the state just an awful lot more efficient than it potentially is now.
Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator DeCrye. So I understand that. I was just wondering, have we had documented instances in which the legislative, executive, or judicial branch hired employees that weren't eligible to work in the United States, we trained them, and then had to fire them after we figured out that they weren't eligible? Do you know of any cases that has happened in this hiring process?
Senator DeCrye.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hayden, I don't know of any cases like that directly.
Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's fairly upfront. I just often think about these bills as they come. Thinking about Senator Patricia Torres-Reyes and her long tenure here is that it seems like we're bringing these bills forward, and there has been no identified issue or problem with it. That the process that we have seems to be efficient and working well, and that frankly, unfortunately, this almost appears to be an inefficient use of our time to continue to go over bill after bill after bill where there doesn't seem to be an issue. So, I guess there's not a reason not to support it, but I'm just a little intrigued as to all of the other issues that we might need to deal with. With all due respect, Senator DeCrye, that we have a bill that doesn't seem that there's an issue or a problem and that we're running very well, but we're spending a lot of time thinking about how to potentially look for a problem that doesn't seem to be there.
Right. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Senator DeCrye, I I would love to have a conversation with you. I didn't really know you were bringing this until late yesterday, but a couple of things. You know, I came to work for the state as a resident, and the process is pretty rigorous. I actually worked for the county first and then for the state before I became a citizen a few years back. And the process that is in place is actually very rigorous, particularly for people who are not citizens. We have to really document quite well that we are, you know, legal residents of the country to work for the government. And that has become even more complicated today. And so I'm just curious. I have, I have an impression that you're a very pragmatic person. So I don't want to make any conclusions as to why do you want to bring this before us and why you want to put together, why you put together this bill. But my question is very similar to Senator Hayden's. From personal experience, I actually know that the process is pretty rigorous. And we had these conversations with Governor Pawlenty, and he concluded, they did an extensive review of it, and they concluded that actually indeed it's a very rigorous process. That's why they never came back here to actually move forward any policy or any direction, because they knew that it was very rigorous. So my question is, why are you pursuing this? What is the benefit, do you think? If we don't have a problem, why do we need to do this? Because there is a cost associated with this. There is, you know, to implement it, the program itself is free, but to implement it and to have the programmers do it in here and to do the audits, that costs money. And I would like to hear the commissioners, we need to know how much is the cost and why do you want to do it?
Senator DeCryf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Torres-Ray, you suggested that I'm a pragmatic person. My wife would probably agree with you. but I'm also about efficiency. And I believe that this makes a hiring process much more efficient, where you're talking about a matter of a few minutes and finding out whether somebody is a legal documented worker in this country or something that could take several months and thousands of dollars in training only to take this person and have to let them go. This just seems an awful lot more efficient. And I believe that the state, every time we have an opportunity, we should be able to work as efficiently as businesses. So this is a way for the state of Minnesota to get up to speed and be efficient. And I don't think you talk about the rigor. I don't think this is any more rigorous. This is filling out a 9-9 form that each of us has had to do. And it's just a matter of taking just a few minutes to put it into the system. So, and you get the answer back most times in about 3 or 4 seconds.
But, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Torres-Ray.
This is in addition, though, Senator, no. Because we need to complete, when you apply for a job, you need to complete information that is required for about your legal status. This is additional. So, you know, I'm not clear as to how this will be instead of what is the exist. Is that what you're proposing? Because it doesn't say that you're proposing to use this instead of the current process that state agencies have with human resources. Is that what you intend to do? Because that's not in here.
Senator DeCryf.
Mr. Chair and Senator Torres-Ray. Current law would require that the I-9 forms get sent in, and it's a longer, more rigorous process.
Right.
By the time you send them in, I have to believe that it takes a few minutes to do that as well. So what this does is it's just a lot more efficient, and I have no idea why anyone would be against efficiency in state government when it takes very little, if any, more time than there's already put into it and potentially could save a problem down the road. I think making sure that we're doing things as efficiently as possible, because still with the system that's in place now, if somebody several months later is found to be an undocumented worker doing it the long way, that person still would not be allowed to keep that job. So this way, we would save all of the front-end cost, and it would just be so much more efficient.
Senator Torres, right?
Senator, actually, that's not the case. But I wish, you know, the best thing, I don't want to keep arguing with you. I think that it will be, I don't know if anybody in the audience, I don't know if any, you know, of the state agencies that will have to implement this were alerted to this, because I do know for a fact that this is an additional step. This is a federal-driven step that will have to do more, is more tied to the verification of legal status and then human resources, which already, you know, has in place. They have to, for tax purposes, for all types of regulations that exist today, you have to fill out all of these forms and clearly put that in place in order to hire an individual. That's already being done. So E-Verify is a system that is really intended to verify legal status, which we have never had a problem because our human resources process really is a rigorous process through which you will never find really a problem. We haven't had this problem in Minnesota. The governor concluded we haven't had this problem, and all of us concluded in the community that this was really, you know, an attempt that he made to have a kind of a political statement about undocumented workers and illegal immigration. And if that's, you know, the case here, and that's the intention, be it. If he wanted to do that, and I said that to him, you're running soon for president, that's okay. But I don't think that we should do this because it's not necessary, Senator, and that's all I'm saying.
Mr. Chairman? Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Well, I'm trying to process this discussion between Senator DeCraif and Senator Torres-Ray. The rigorous process, there's a rigorous process for hiring, and that includes more than just this type of a verification. And I would assume this system that has been put in place, you believe, would shorten the time that it would take the normal hiring process to go through the motions of doing the same thing. It's not going to replace the rest of the hiring process. It's just in that area, and that you believe that it actually is more efficient. Is that what I'm hearing you say? And I'm trying to understand that Senator Torres-Ray feels that other process needs to stay there, and then this is on top of. In terms of the other process, I'm not sure if she's meaning that for hiring on a broader scale, that everybody, regardless if they're, you know, were born here and never set foot out of the country, versus whether, you know, where they came from, that they still are going to go through hiring steps, but that actual documentation is what you're pointing out, and that this, you believe, is more efficient.
Senator DeCraif.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Olson. Currently, people still have to fill out an I-9 form. They do now, and they will still have to, even with this process.
That's everybody.
Everybody. But with the current process, that I-9 form gets sent away, and it's months at times before we find out, you know, how that status turns out, you know, if they're a legal documented worker or not. Under this system, it's instantaneous. They fill it out. It takes 4 to 6 minutes to fill it out, and the average is about 3 to 5 seconds later, the answer is back. And at that point, you know, you can, you know, the person, you know, and I think like 98.3% are automatically confirmed. So there's a very, very low percentage that is found not to be. And by the way, of the 1.7% that come back as a mismatch, only 3% are later confirmed to be work authorized. So what I'm saying by that statement is the system works. It works very, very well. When they find somebody is not authorized, there's of that 1.7% to get the terminology correct, a system mismatch. I want to repeat, only 3% of those people are found to be an incorrect answer. So it's a very high probability that if somebody comes back as a mismatch that they are not a documented worker. So the system works. Why wouldn't we use it?
Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, Senator DeCrafe, as a private business owner, one of the challenges that we face is training employees. It is a tremendous cost of a business to train employees, to bring them in. And I've had cases where people have been with us for a short period of time, and we've invested all that time, energy, dollars to train that employee, only to have them leave. And I don't know that it was for this circumstance, but it just seems to me that this is a small cost or a small investment to protect that and to protect those investment dollars or those training dollars that, we invest. And the efficiency that we need as a state, and we're looking for every dollar we can to provide for the programs that are so important to the residents of Minnesota that all of us around this table have fought for and continue to fight for, that it seems like a very small thing to do in order to assure that if we're training our employees, state employees, that they are employees that are qualified and able to work in our state. So to me, this is a very, very reasonable thing to be doing, given the exemplary cost of not doing this.
Do we have testifiers? I believe we might have a couple that I've got listed on the list. Please come forward. Please state your name and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Benjamin Gerber. I am the labor policy manager for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We are here today to testify in opposition to this bill. The Minnesota Chamber believes that immigration law and E-Verify are within the exclusive purview of the federal government. The U.S. Chamber worked with United States Congressman Lamar Smith, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, on E-Verify language in H.R. 2885. The key to the agreement between the Chamber and Representative Smith was strong, and I emphasize strong, language that a federal E-Verify law specifically preempts all state and local immigration law. We would also like to point out that a United States Senate file 1196, introduced by Iowa Senator Grassley, would look at fixing the nationwide problems and implementation of E-Verify. Federal immigration is important to maintaining a strong and productive workforce in this country. The Minnesota Chamber, along with the U.S. Chamber, believes that immigration law, including E-Verify, should not become products of state laws and regulations, which will leave us with a patchwork of unworkable and inefficient state law across our nation. It is important to note that the federal government has long, for a long time, has not made any progress on immigration reform, and now we see bills moving through both federal bodies for the first time in a long time. And we see that there is some consensus to these issues. We respectfully request that you delay implementing any attempts at mandating E-Verify in any parts of the state economy for this specific reason. Thank you very much.
Mr. Gerber, am I hearing that the Minnesota Chamber is advocating for a national E-Verify law? Is that how am I to interpretate what you just said?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the question. We are, the U.S. Chamber has worked out an agreement with Lamar Smith, who Republican from Texas, a congressman from Texas. And the reason why the U.S. Chamber has been in agreement with this federal legislation is the strong preemption language. And so from a state chamber perspective, we believe that that immigration is solely a federal issue and that any attempts by the state is a bad idea because it leaves us with this patchwork of inefficient state regulations that make it hard for businesses to operate across the country. So we need one federal solution and not a smattering of state legislation that doesn't allow for a workable solution.
So am I to take that as a yes?
We support a federal solution to this issue.
All right. And one other question: Are any of your members affected by this bill?
Mr. Chairman, no, none of our members are affected by this specific bill, but our concern is that immigration is a federal issue and shouldn't be, states shouldn't operate in this realm.
Thank you. Well, Senator Cohen? Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to understand this. E-Verify is a federal program, is it not?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, yes, E-Verify is a federal program.
Senator Olson?
And all this says is that in our employment decisions that we should use that as the process for identifying it. I'm trying to understand. We're not recreating E-Verify, or this bill isn't attempting to do that. I don't understand, you know, what your concern is. I presume that if you have the E-Verify system, you're suggesting that the federal government is the one that's responsible for determining whether you as private sector have to use it or don't have to use it or whatever. I don't get it. I don't get there's a disconnect for me between your position and what Senator Kreif is attempting to do is essentially validating the value of the federal E-Verify and not having to, you know, there's no effort in here to duplicate it. It's just use it because it's more efficient to use it than the process that they're using, that we are using now to, in fact, determine that. Eligibility.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Gerber.
Senator Olson, what our concern is this is one step closer to a patchwork of different state laws. Immigration, if we're going to have comprehensive immigration reform, it needs to come from the federal government so all states operate under the same rules. When we start seeing states enact different laws, it makes it a lot more difficult for businesses and others to operate across state lines. That's why it's really important that we defer to the federal government when deciding immigration issues.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Olson,
what rules are – there's no rules being proposed. It's just an issue in the hiring process of use the federal system rather than create your own is what he seems to be attempting to do. It doesn't add up to me. I mean, I know the federal government often bullies us into doing things that they want us to do. We're saying – you seem to be on the right track. This is easier, and we'll be an example, and we'll use it. And you know, I'm certainly not one who likes Fed entanglement with the Feds, and I usually don't have all that great confidence in what they do. You obviously do, and we're kind of demonstrating that this is an area where perhaps they've got it right. I'm not talking about their policy. This doesn't deal with their policy on immigration, and goodness only knows that needs work. And I don't know how long it takes for them to wake up and do it, but that's another matter, and it's not for us to determine.
Senator DeKreif.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm an advocate for local control. I'm an advocate for state control over federal, for county control, oftentimes over state, and I like townships. But what I'd like to point out here is this is a situation, as Senator Olson has pointed out, that we're not trying to change E-Verify. We're not trying to change the system. All we're trying to do is suggest that we should follow along with this program. Thus far, in 2011, 12 states have enacted legislation with E-Verify provisions. 17 states currently require the use of E-Verify for public and or private employers, 15 through legislation, and 2, Florida and Idaho, through executive orders. Minnesota and Rhode Island previously enacted executive orders requiring state agencies and contractors to use Verify, but the orders were rescinded in 2011. So I actually don't understand the chamber's position on this, because if the national chamber believes in E-Verify and they want the federal government to take it on, I absolutely believe that each of our states should have the ability to enact, to agree with it ourselves. And that's all we're attempting to do here.
Senator Gazelka, to that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And no matter what Minnesota does then, there's not going to be conformity across all the states. If there's a bunch that already have it and we have it with, we're going to be with that group that has it.
Senator Cohen, did you want to ask your question now?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Gerber. So what's the status of Smith versus Grassley then right now?
Mr. Gerber?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, I believe Lamar Smith, or Representative LeVar Smith, who's the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, I believe it passed out of his committee and is waiting further action. So there's more, and we support Representative Smith's bill specifically because of the strong preemption language. And that's what I want to address, that we don't have what our position is that if one state's going to do it, everybody should have to do it. And that's why we are going with Representative Smith's language for that strong preemption, because of the problem with a patchwork of state immigration laws that are unworkable.
And Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
So the Minnesota Chamber supports the Smith approach and opposes this bill.
Mr. Gerber.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, yes, we oppose this bill because it's a state attempt to deal with a federal issue.
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Cohen. I realize you're here representing the Chamber. You can't necessarily speak for any other business organizations. Do you know, are you able to state comfortably, and if not, you know, if you can't answer, whether or not other business organizations have a similar approach to the Business Partnership or the Itasca Group or any of those organizations? Or is that putting you in an unfair
Mr. Gerber?
Position? Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, I can't speak for other organizations, but there are other groups to here that are going to testify that might be able to better address those.
Okay.
Mr. Gerber, could you tell me what the patchwork problem is and how this affects that patchwork problem when we're just verifying? And I go back because I'm thinking of what Senator Lilly talked about. I have hired and trained people, and I can't imagine me not wanting to know that person should be here after making all the investments. I'm finding it hard that the Minnesota Chamber would look at that as a positive cost potential. Proactive potential cost-saving measure for companies throughout the state of Minnesota, and you keep bringing up this patchwork. We're not changing immigration laws. We're not doing anything to that. We're just verifying the person in a very quick, high-tech way to do the verification. So I'm going to allow you a little time here to try to explain to this guy just how that's affecting this, whatever this patchwork is.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the question. If you look at, I think Arizona is the perfect example, and there was a lot of controversy over the last 2 years over their immigration policies. And there was concern from business communities and various different groups. And the reason is when you have each state having their own immigration policy, then it's a lot harder to do business among the states. And we represent a lot of small businesses, but we also represent large businesses. And there's small and large businesses in the state of Minnesota that either due to their proximity to state borders or because they have a reach outside the state, they have to comply with the laws of other states. Now, if they're forced to have to go with E-Verify in one state, and each state has a different process for proving the legality of their workforce, it becomes burdensome, and it becomes a mandate on businesses that isn't efficient or effective. And that's what we see as a patchwork. When each state starts enacting their own laws, it's not efficient or effective for these businesses. And that's the position of the chamber.
Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Gerber, so earlier you stated that this does not impact any of your your members' businesses directly, and yet what we're just talking about is a patchwork affecting businesses. So can we talk a little bit about a business's responsibility with E-Verify, with the I-9 forms, and et cetera? Let's talk a little bit about what businesses do go through. But let's not talk about something that doesn't impact the businesses, which your members, which this does not.
Mr. Gerber?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure the question that you're asking.
Well, there's Senator Lilly.
2 points, Mr. Chairman. Just restating your earlier testimony that this does not affect your business members directly. But secondly, if you could talk a little bit about what do businesses have to go through as far as verifying their employees currently in Minnesota?
Mr. Gerber?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lilly, I believe we have a representative from the immigration law community that would be the best person to describe that. I'm not an immigration law expert, so I don't want to misrepresent anything. And so I'll let them handle that question if that's appropriate.
Excuse me here. Senator DeCryf, is this bill an ethnic bill that's geared at one group of people, or is this something that anybody has to go through, or everybody? I mean, I'm starting to see this thing going down the wrong path in my mind. I thought E-Verify was for anybody that wanted to, regardless of race, creed, or color, that wanted to become a state employee. Am I not reading this right? Because I'm hearing things that make it sound like we're trying to pick on one group over the other.
Mr. Chair, what this bill simply does is just with state hires. And so, I mean, that to me, the chamber, in my opinion, is talking about something that doesn't affect businesses in Minnesota at all. This is simply for state hires. All it does is simply makes the system more easier to work their way through and much, much quicker. Efficiency is the word I was looking for. Thanks. Makes it much more efficient. The same answer, I believe, would likely come up with either the old way that takes months, where you potentially could have months of training, as Senator Lilly has brought up, and then have to let somebody go because you find that they are an undocumented worker. And quite frankly, we have a lot of people that are immigrants that are documented workers, and this system would allow them to work. So I see nothing in here that talks about...
Thank you. Senator Carlson?
Just quickly, Mr. Chair, thank you. I've been a little bit removed from the HR process in my business, but it was always the practice that we had to fill out an I-9 on any new employee. Is that not still the practice?
It is.
Okay, so therefore, if that is still the practice, it's my understanding, and I may be wrong, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that the E-Verify simply automates the I-9 process and does exactly what Senator Lilly was talking about, is that it eliminates that lag time of finding out if somebody is legally in the United States, and so eliminate that extra training that would go to waste. Is that correct or not correct?
Senator DeCryf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Carlson, to my knowledge, that is correct. This would simply speed the process up. After a few minutes of putting the information into the database, 3 to 5 seconds later, it kicks out an answer.
I have two. First, Senator Torres, right? Senator Olson had her hand up first, and so Senator Olson.
Well, I would defer to Senator Torres, okay, if she's got an explanation, because what I'm hearing is I think there's some fear out there. I don't know, maybe everybody isn't required to verify now, and they're afraid the states are going to start to establish their own immigration policy, which I think is what you were referring to in terms of Arizona. I think the effort needs to be, if the immigration policy shouldn't be set by the states, it should be set by the federal government and keep the pressure on. But they've set up a verification system. I don't know, do they require that everybody verify? That's what this E-9 form is? I'm not even familiar with that.
I-9.
Or whatever it is. I'm kind of befuddled by this discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Excuse me. Did you want to answer that or
go? Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I actually am with you. I know I hear a lot of people that seem to be afraid of this, and it seems to me that it's not doing anything other than making the process much more efficient to come up with the same answer. And I have no idea why efficiency should be a bad thing in Minnesota.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator DeCryf, it seems to me that what I'm wondering about is we don't like the current immigration policy, so we don't want to be held to it, and we're afraid that we may have to be held to it.
Senator Olson.
And that is If that's the case,
that's correct.
Senator, that's the problem with the federal government. If you don't like that policy, we shouldn't be the ones changing it. They are. We're just following the attempting to use the efficiency they've created in the system. Now, get with the program and try to address the fact that we've got policies that are probably keeping people out that would be a benefit here, as well as encouraging people to come here illegally, which is, you know, none of us like either, because our laws aren't made to be broken. They should be honored, and it just kind of undermines the meaning of any law. And I think it needs your efforts, instead of picking at something this simple, is one that ought to be focused on the federal government and telling them to get their set whatever body part in gear and get this work done.
I think we're going to move on here. We have another testifier. I want to make sure the testifiers that are here today have a chance. So please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Carolyn Jackson. I'm the lobbying coordinator for the ACLU of Minnesota. The ACLU opposes the use of E-Verify on both the state and the federal level because it's an over-reliance on a database which is flawed. In 2007, the Social Security Administration estimated that 17.8 million records contained discrepancies related to name, date of birth, or citizenship status. Reliance on the E-Verify database leads to both false positives and false negatives. Because this is one database by which employment is run against, there's incredible incentive for identity theft and to break into it. And there are the GAO, the Government Accounting Office, notes in 2010, December, that the E-Verify remains vulnerable to identity theft and employer fraud. The problem with false negatives is that someone gets a tentative non-confirmation notice, which is if you run through E-Verify and it says you're not allowed to work, then what happens is if it's someone you really want to hire, maybe you'll take the time to go through and run through the bureaucratic process of verifying that. But often it also encourages employers to discriminate on the basis of race and other reasons. So that's another, and the employee oftentimes is not told that there was a tentative non-confirmation, so they can't go back and say, hey, you used the wrong middle name, you spelled it wrong. If you use the correct middle name, you'll see that I am qualified to work. So there's a lack of due process. There are errors in the system. And when North Dakota looked at this, they instituted a study just last year, and you know, as an alternative to passing this today, maybe we could do like North Dakota did and do a study to see whether there are the level of errors that are in this system. Thank you.
Ms. Jackson, listening to your testimony, you said the database is flawed. And with that, has the ACLU instituted any lawsuits this point?
Senator Perry, the ACLU sued the Social Security Administration, I believe, in 2006 on this very issue, and it was found that use of the Social Security database at that point in time did violate due process because it was so riddled with errors, and the fact that they've been working to clean it up is a direct result of that lawsuit, and they continue to monitor it to this day.
Senator DeCraig.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to point out a couple things that lead, you know, to I believe what's being talked about here. I want to repeat something I said a little earlier. 98.3% of employees are automatically confirmed as authorized to work either instantly or within 24 hours. And then of the 1.7% of employees receiving initial system mismatches, only 3% of that 1.7% later are confirmed to be authorized. So the system works. It's very, very accurate, and it works. And non-confirmations occur almost exclusively because, number one, the employee is not authorized to work in the United States. Number two, the employee failed to update his or her records with the Social Security Administration. The employer made an error when entering information into the E-Verify system. and the E-Verify received a score of 82 on the National Customer Satisfaction Index, which is 13 points higher than the current federal government average. So the system works, and that's why I believe we absolutely have to move forward with it.
Mr. Chairman,
do we have any further testimony?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Senator Kreif, I heard you this time say 93.8. Did you mean 98.3?
Yes, 98.3, I'm sorry.
You to,
thank you.
All right, thank you.
Further testimony? Please state your name and you may proceed.
My name is John Keller. I'm the Executive Director of the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify. I want to direct my testimony at some issues that have already been covered, but raise an issue of concern that has not yet been reached or talked about, and that is that the state of Minnesota has attempted to use E-Verify in the past. As was mentioned, I think, by Senator Torres-Rae, an executive order in 2008 brought forward E-Verify for the state of Minnesota. And I just want to go through very quickly what happened at that point. So in January of 2008, E-Verify was implemented through executive order. 18 months went by with no action on behalf of the state, took no action to implement E-Verify. What happened next, and one of the main reasons why no action was taken, was because of security concerns about how the data would be managed. And who would actually do that work. The state of Minnesota decided after an investigation by the Office of the Legislative Auditor that they would hire an outside private contractor to handle all of their E-Verify work. Outlook Services was hired, and within a short amount of time, Outlook Services was fired because they had improperly allowed 500 state employees' records to be accessed by a simple Google search. The issue or the argument that E-Verify is simple, that it's worked very well or is working very well, flies in direct contrast with the state of Minnesota's own history of using E-Verify in the past. A lawsuit was initiated by Outlook Services against the state of Minnesota. There's no accounting for the amount of time that was spent trying to find an appropriate private contractor to handle the state's E-Verify business before it selected Outlook Services. 18 months were spent in that process. The Attorney General's office was involved in trying to find sufficient protections within the contract between Minnesota and Outlook Services to run that program. Eventually, they agreed to use Outlook Services, and in the subsequent investigation by the Office of Legislative Auditor, and that report is, of course, available to you all, issued April 21st, 2010, they found that the people who were looking into using E-Verify and choosing a private contractor didn't take into consideration any of the data security issues. In fact, their final recommendation was that if any additional use of E-Verify is to be used, it must first be cleared with the Office of Enterprise Technology, which I never knew existed, but apparently exists here for the state. I see nothing in the fiscal note that raises whether or not the Office of Enterprise Technology has looked at our current attempt to expand E-Verify and whether or not we've learned from any of the mistakes the last time we tried to use it. So that's one issue that I encourage before any action is taken, that we review what happened the last time. There's already been two investigations by the Office of Legislative Auditor into this issue, and again, I don't think that speaks very highly of the efficiency. So that's sort of the past history. And I'll reiterate at this point some of the testimony by the Chamber of Commerce, and that is that the E-Verify, maybe I should start by clarifying the hiring process and how E-Verify will or will not impact the hiring process. What's in place right now for all employers, whether you're private, public, nonprofit, is what was created in 1986. The Federal Immigration Reform and Control Act created the I-9 form. Everyone who hires another individual as an employee must fill out the I-9 form. If you use E-Verify, you are not exempted from that requirement to fill out the I-9 form. The The I-9 form sets out what documentation is required to establish your eligibility to work in the United States. And I'm not sure of the testimony by the author, but the verification of whether that those documents are legitimate or sufficient to comply with the I-9 begins and ends with the hiring employer. There's no sending off of the documents that I'm aware of under the current I-9 form and requirements. So, again, the idea that bringing on an additional set of verifications is going to create a more efficient process is not consistent with the state's past practice with E-Verify, and I'm aware of no alleviation of the federal requirement that currently is in place for all employers to use the I-9 to continue to use the I-9. There are additional questions raised when I began looking at this bill, which was recent. The bill references audits under one branch of government, the executive branch of government, but no audits under legislative or judicial branch. I don't understand why you would require audits for one but not the other two branches if this is an important piece of verification. So that's an open question, I think, that should be of concern to this committee. The second question, and I haven't heard any testimony yet, is have any members of either the previous administration or of the current administration who've been required to use E-Verify either under the old executive order after the Lookout Services contract was terminated or prospectively been asked for their opinion on how efficient it's either worked in the past or is working today. I haven't heard any of that testimony or seen it in what I've seen in the House. One of the questions that was raised was whether or not this will have a neutral impact on people regardless of their ethnicity. The studies that have looked at the impact of E-Verify, so the false positive, saying that we believe through the verification of data that you are not eligible to work, does disproportionately impact persons with Latino surnames. And this is obvious because of the legal and cultural tradition of using more than one legal surname. What you find in those persons who are, in fact, legal to work in the United States who are Latino and use more than one surname is that it's that discrepancy in both DHS's records and Social Security records where maybe your Social Security card has one name or maybe your DHS records have one or the other or both names. All of those delays, of course, represent a disaffected, eligible employee or potential employee losing time from work and being ineligible to perform their duties. So that's a question that was raised earlier. And I'll wrap up. I don't want to take up too much of your time. I do think that the cost, the fiscal note that looks at the House bill, and I haven't had time to look at whether or not there's any difference in the Senate bill, simply doesn't look into any scenario except for the system working efficiently. And all of the analysis show that there is some percentage of non-confirmations that need additional assistance, that they need to follow up either with the employee or the employee, him or herself, has to move to obtain additional documentation. Additionally, the Office of Technology is not included per the Office of Legislative Auditor's report in any sort of consideration of costs that might be undertaken here. And finally, the last thing that I will mention is that this expansion of E-Verify does, in fact, go beyond the executive order that we had beginning in 2008. The executive order that was created in 2008 applied only to the executive branch. What you see here is the expansion beyond the executive branch into both legislative and the judicial branch. And I think that's an open question, particularly as it relates to an independent branch of government, whether or not there is authority to do that. There certainly isn't precedent in the state's use of E-Verify. With that, I'll conclude my testimony.
Do we have any other testifiers here today? Mr. Gerber?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify something that I didn't have a chance to respond to. I want to make sure I'm not Senator DeCryf and I had a very great good conversation in his office. I'm not accusing anybody of targeting a certain ethnic group. No. When I brought up Arizona, there's more to Arizona's law than the controversial portions that we hear about, and part of that is E-Verify. So I just wanted to say that I was using that. And second, we aren't against E-Verify. We're against states enacting legislation that imposes E-Verify. So just wanted to clear that up. Thank you.
Thank you. We're moving towards a vote here, members. Comments, questions? Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do any of the testifiers know how much in federal tax dollars has been spent to build the E-Verify system?
Looks pretty quiet out there, Senator Ortman. I don't think Crickets. You're going to get a response.
Crickets. Okay, well, I guess my point is that we as taxpayers across the state of Minnesota have invested in this system, and that means something to me. I don't want you to discount the system that I'm trying to build and trying to put to good use. And I think we're talking here about state government employees. We are their employers. And I think that it's perfectly appropriate for us to do a background check, make sure that these folks are here legally to work, that the federal government agrees that they're here legally to work. I did not hear any of you come up with an amendment to say that we should add in the opportunity to check a false positive or to review disqualifying information that comes back from the federal government, but I think that would make sense. And for those that maybe disagree with this approach, I think maybe you should draft that amendment. I think that would be very helpful to the ACLU in particular. I thought that was a good point, but I think we could probably add that in. And with respect to the comment about the audits as well, it certainly could be expanded to do that. But I think taxpayers in Minnesota have invested in that federal system. I think that's a system that certainly President Obama and the federal Congress supports, and I think that we should be working together with the federal government. If we don't like E-Verify, then we should work at the national level to say that this is not a good system. I know there's been a lawsuit. It also sounds like there have been some results following the lawsuit, and that the system is working. We're making improvements. So I didn't hear anything about our investment at the federal level. If you have that information to follow up, I would appreciate that. And I would hope that those that have these specific concerns would work with Senator DeCryf to maybe work through an amendment.
Senator Hayden.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just thinking about that. I wasn't actually prepared, and that might just be me being new for this bill. But and so my comments were, I didn't think that there just seemed to be a problem. As we kind of walk throughout the traditional way in which we do this work, and then we get our testifiers who shine the light that there is a long history, along with Senator Torres Reyes, on this issue. And so what seems to be just a paragraph, a small bill that just makes a lot of sense, seems to have a lot of issues and a lot of history, Senator DeCryf. And so I know that we have had Commissioner of Administration, who's a personal favorite of yours, Mr. Chair, and others that really should probably be here and help us walk through this issue, help us think about what it means to do this. We might need to have somebody from the Attorney General's office to help us understand what the suit was, what happened when they let the contract out, and why I think about all the privacy folks around here who I talk to each and every day who are very concerned about privacy, and there was a breach in this last round. So I'm not saying that all of that would get us to a different outcome, but I think it's helpful in this particular body, in this particular committee, to understand all of the history, the issues, the problems that we had in the past, and how this would work moving forward, as opposed to what appeared to be at the very beginning of this is a very simple program and a very simple change, and all we needed to do was just make the simple language in the law, and then we'd move forward and everything would be okay. That doesn't appear to be the issue, Mr. Chair. So with that, I move to table to put this bill on the table and hopefully have another hearing in which we can get those that have the expertise in the administration, those that have worked on the issue, that can give us a little bit of a background legally, and then have a better sense, Senator, on how we can implement this and maybe take in consideration after that testimony that the fiscal note isn't so small, that it might be a much larger fiscal note. And I think that would be worthy of this committee to take a look at.
The motion is not debatable. All those in favor of laying the bill on the table signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Division.
Division.
The chairman hasn't called the vote yet.
Yes, to roll.
Oh.
Motion does not prevail. Division has been called for. All those in favor of laying this on the table, raise your hand. Okay, thank you. All those opposed to laying on the table, raise your hand. The motion does not prevail. Okay, further discussion. Torres Ray, you had your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The motion to lay it over for discussion for me was an important one, Senator Hayden, because there is a lot of history. We work with the Pawlenty administration. I am so incredibly impressed, Mr. Keller, with your notes and your memory. I wish I had all of this documentation, but I am not an attorney, so I don't keep track of all of these things as well as you do. So thank you for that. So all I want to say is that Senator LaCroix, the system that we have in place in the state of Minnesota in legislative, executive, and judicial branches is pretty thorough, and that we, through the human resources offices, in fact, we do collect information. And as I said, I personally participated on a process to which I had to provide my Social Security card, not even a copy of it. You have to provide your Social Security card and your residence card, when you apply, and they make copies of it, and you know it's a very rigorous process. E-Verify is a different process. It's tied to immigration status through the federal government. And you're trying to bring that to the state of Minnesota really without a need. Maybe, you know, we have it, therefore we should use it, we paid for it, is an argument that some senators, you know, will argue for. But this is not necessary. We have ample history of not being able to implement this. The Pawlenty administration tried and failed, and that's why they got so quiet on it. This governor is going to have to bring that to you and let you know that they cannot implement it, that it's not cost-effective, that it doesn't help, and it doesn't solve any problem. And I just want to let you know that you're just moving legislation that is unnecessary, and we know this because we have worked on it for years. So I wish, you know, I could change your mind, but I have not been able to for 2 years. Your caucus just works together on these issues regardless of the testimony that you hear from experts. You just keep moving. And so it's just for the record that I just say what I said.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, I take very seriously what you said, Senator Torres, right?
No, I don't think so.
And I had just spoken with Senator DeCrieff to ask him if he would be willing to let us work on a couple of amendments to address the concerns we've heard from experts here today. And I think there are some improvements that we can and should make. And I'm hopeful that Senator DeCrieff would agree to have us lay this bill on the table, work on a couple of things with the experts, and bring it back. Mr. Chair.
Senator DeCrieff.
Mr. Chair, I would be agreeable to laying it on the table and work on an amendment to get this in order so that the committee might have a better feeling about it.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator DeCrape. I hope you come back, too, with information about how much we lost on the E-Verify system when it was used under the Pawlenty administration. because I know we probably had a pretty big contract with a company that was hired to do this. And it is, I know, oftentimes we're hiring contractors from the state level, and then we're giving them information that's that would be protected under HIPAA, and instead it's not. It's for whatever reason gets out publicly, and I think that puts the state at great risk of lawsuits, continuous lawsuits. And as long as this system has not been proven to be fail-proof, as we've heard it hasn't, then I really hope that we can take a much closer look at this, because it's just a waste of time to go through this legislation, then find out it's so costly, and then the governor vetoes it, and you have a pretty good idea that's what he's going to do, when we've got real issues that we have to resolve in this legislative session before the end.
Okay. I don't think anybody should be fearful of bringing a bill before a committee because a select governor, whoever that might be, would be willing to veto it. These are things that need to be aired and need to be aired the best that they can. So the fear of a veto should never stop any legislation. Senator Ortman.
Chair, I would respectfully move that we lay this bill on the table.
Senator Ortman moves that we lay Senate File 1842 on the table. All in favor, I'm sure will be aye.
Aye.
Aye. Oh. So be it. There being no further business before this committee, we are adjourned.